are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Hey, folks. Sam Steeder here. Just a reminder, the AM Quickie has now moved to its own feed. You can go through Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Podcasts, or you can go to amquickie.com to sign up for it. Do it now. You get the headlines in less than 5 minutes. Okay, start this other show.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, October 7th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the 5-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ian Haney Lopez, the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at the University of California, Berkeley, on Merge Left, fusing race and class, winning elections, and saving America. Also on the program today, there's a second Ukrainian call whistleblower, this one with direct knowledge of that call, as if we needed it. It's all there. That indictment is sewn up, as far as I'm concerned. Meanwhile, Trump invites Turkey to kill millions of our Kurdish allies in Syria. Federal judge orders Trump's taxes handed over to the Manhattan DA. Trump people have appealed. We'll find out soon. Oops, Rick Perry as the fall guy. Turns out Trump donors were running a parallel shakedown in Ukraine. Meanwhile, Trump will deny immigrant visas unless they can prove they have health insurance. White House is subpoenaed. Mick Mulvaney gets an offer he will but shouldn't refuse. 6,000 injured, over 100 dead as Iraqi security forces shoot protesters. Bernie Sanders releases a campaign finance reform plan that at the very least calls for no corporate donations to that 2020 convention. And socialist tops the polls in Portugal will form a left alliance government. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Brendan on the board today. Exceptional job on the music, the fade in, fade out, whatever it was.
I've learned so much from Matt Leck over these few years.
Honestly, today was exceptional. Well done. We've got a lot of news. We're going to do. We're going to dedicate tomorrow's show to that news, and I was hoping also to talk about the Supreme Court. We're going to have to probably put that on hold and maybe talk about that in the coming days. Everything's getting jammed up for me because of the Jewish holidays, and then we have the Democratic debate. And Columbus Day, and then the following week I will be going to Las Vegas for the Tort Lawyer Conference. So, but we will endeavor to get you as much as possible. I mentioned at the beginning, at the top of the show, the AM Quickie. It's a good way of just getting a rundown of some of these top stories that we don't necessarily have time to get into, but you should be aware at least because these will be ongoing narratives in a lot of instances. The impeachment stuff. I mean, like I said, we could impeach right now. There's no doubt in my mind that there is sufficient evidence for, I think, multiple articles of impeachment. But why stop now? Because there, I mean, if this is the way he ran the relationship with Ukraine, just to get dirt on Hunter Biden and to prove this wild conspiracy theory from 2016. What about when we're talking about like him filling bags of money? Like, I mean, does anyone have any sort of sense of like, oh, the reason why Donald Trump is essentially selling out the Kurds? Not essentially, is selling out the Kurds. And remember how hurt he was about the kids? When he thought about, like, we're not going to bomb Iran because of the kids. Like, I realized, like, there might be a kid who died. Does anyone think that he is selling out the Kurds this way because of some ideological or geopolitical notions that he's been harboring for a long time? I mean, it's not as if there are entities in the Republican Party who are necessarily all excited about this. He's opening the door to full ethnic cleansing. And you have to ask yourself why. I mean, Lindsey Graham, he's running around. His hair is on fire. He can't believe this from Donald Trump. Who could have imagined? But he's even lost Brian Kilmeade on Fox and Friends. Now, there are times where people, even like Brian Kilmeade, can be correct about things. Maybe not necessarily for the same reasons as we may have. Maybe sometimes for the same reasons. But it can happen. But if anybody thinks that Donald Trump is doing this because he thinks his base is like, when are we going to let Turkey go in there and roust the Kurds? Or if he's had, you know, from his days back in, dabbling with, foreign policy people, like some notion about the balance of power in that region is really fundamentally rests in Turkey's ability to undercut any type of threat from the Kurds. I mean, he's getting something from someone or some entity, or maybe multiple ones.
Yeah, he wants to open a Trump Tower in Istanbul.
I mean, it could be that. It could be that straightforward, or it could be some other bank shot.
There were arms deals on the line.
I mean, who knows? But an impeachment not only allows you to impeach him for the things that we already know about, it gives you the ability to say to anybody who's going to withhold documents from you that that act in and of itself can be construed as obstruction and an article of impeachment, which makes it a lot harder for people to hold back information. And so you use this power to dig up the other rot that exists there. In the meantime, I mentioned Brian Kilmeade can sometimes be right. Here he is. But it's one of those horrible, awkward situations where apparently Steve Doocy showed up late for work and just rushed in and did not get the talking points of the day. So he's very confused.
Just what a disaster. I mean, the president's statement through Stephanie Grisham is, you know, we defeated the caliphate, the caliphate's destroyed. We would not have done that without the Kurds, who did all of our fighting. While our guys, the reason why our casualties were so low is because Kurds did all the fighting.
Pause it. Now, you remember over the past couple of years where Brian Kilmeade would always give credit as he was talking about Donald Trump getting rid of ISIS, where he would say it was the Kurds, right? You all remember that. But if you've forgotten, I understand, because it never happened. But here we go.
Of our fighting, while our guys, the reason why our casualties were so low is because Kurds did all the fighting. Now we're saying, right, okay, Turks, go wipe them out or force them out. What kind of message is that to the next ally that wants to side with us? Meanwhile, we're taking Sunni prisoners and giving them to Sunni Turkey, who has been nothing but irresponsible, though technically a NATO ally. A disastrous series of events. I hope the president will rethink this.
I think the president is doing exactly what he wants to, because he has made from the get-go very clear
to release ISIS fighters.
campaign promise to end and you know wars in other countries
and abandon our allies. That's a campaign promise. Well, abandon the people that got the caliphate destroyed.
I think when people find out that somebody else is willing to take over the fight against ISIS, they're going to be okay.
Who's taking it?
Well,
Turkey's not going to fight ISIS.
We have given Turkey permission to do that and to take. And the quote was, Turkey will now be responsible for all ISIS fighters.
Right. And kill the, and wipe out the Kurds. Are you kidding me? Again, we're abandoning our most loyal allies who did all our fighters. All we did is arm them and they did all the work. And now we say, good luck. Good luck surviving.
Well, it looks like that's the tack the White House and the president's going to take. We're going to have more reports from Washington, D.C. What do you think about this? The fact that it looks like we're going to pull out. And Turkey's going to take over. Email us, friends at foxnews.com.
And abandon.
Okay, let's talk about impeachment.
Wow. They're going to have the things at the commissary at Fox are going to be a little bit uncomfortable today.
What the hell is going on over there?
Well, no. I mean, Kilmeade, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, he's, first of all, you have to feel for Brian Kilmeade because he's watched two Republican presidents do the exact same thing to the Kurds multiple times, starting with George H.W. Bush back in 1993, where he basically called for the Kurds to rise up in northern Iraq. And after, you know, in the sort of the wake of our invasion of Iraq, the, you know, part one. Based upon a series of lies that were perpetrated by some spokespeople talking about Kuwaiti babies, et cetera, called for the Kurds to rise up in northern Iraq. And then when they did, was like, actually, I'm sorry, I didn't realize what time it was. We've got to go. Caused a massive slaughter of Kurds in Iraq. And now we're doing it again with people who even Brian Kilmeade concedes have been fighting against ISIS, basically Donald Trump's greatest victory, and he has sold them out. The question is, why? In fact, not only does the statement not even say that the Turks, that Turkey is going to be fighting ISIS, all they're going to do is get a hold of the ISIS prisoners that we have captured. And in that statement that they referenced, President Trump spoke with President Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey by telephone. Turkey will soon be moving forward with its long-planned operation into northern Syria. The United States Armed Forces will not support or be involved in the operation. That's very nice of us. The United States forces, having defeated the ISIS territorial caliphate, will no longer be in the immediate area. But we haven't really been there anyways. So it's not like any type of, we're not pulling back our troops.
It's like a
we're just basically pulling back our promise to the Kurds. We're basically just pulling back our diplomatic powers and saying, OK, fine, head in. The United States government has pressed France, Germany and other European nations from which many captured ISIS fighters came to take them back. But they did not want them and refused. I'm quite convinced Donald Trump wrote that sentence. Maybe he dictated it.
Yeah, it almost reads like a tweet of his.
The United States will not hold them for what could be many years at great cost to the United States taxpayer. Turkey will now be responsible for all ISIS fighters in the area captured over the past 2 years in the wake of the defeat of the territorial caliphate by the United States. I mean, maybe this is just the deal. Like, it's worth it. We're going to allow for the ethnic cleansing that will take place. The undoubtedly tens of thousands of Kurds who will be killed in that region, maybe more, maybe a little bit less, who will be killed in that region so that we don't have to deal with the prisoners that we supposedly have in our custody. And I don't even know what that number is. But I want to say it's unbelievable, but it's totally believable. We'll talk more about that later in the program.
I can't wait to see the pretty face that Jimmy Dore tries to put on this one.
I mean, I will say this. You know, that granted, Hillary Clinton would have already had us in World War III by this point, and we would all be dead. But this is not something that Hillary Clinton would have done. I mean, assuming that she wasn't overtaken by Parkinson's. Hey, are you trying to drink more water? Liquid IV hydrates you 2 to 3 times faster and more efficiently than water alone, with the added bonus of vitamin C, B3, B5, B6, B12. I will tell you this right now. I will cop to it. Saturday night, I didn't eat very long. I had a couple more, too many drinks. I did not drink any water before I went to bed. Next morning, the first thing I do, a liquid IV. It hydrates you faster than water does, just water alone. Replenishes you, makes you feel better. I use it when I travel quite a bit. I use it when I exercise, a little bit before, a little bit after. Get those vitamins in my muscles. And everybody loves around here. And also when I'm sick.
Had one this weekend before the wedding I went to.
Boom. Fastest growing wellness brand in the country. Their products are non-GMO, vegan, free of gluten, free of dairy, free of soy. And you can find it everywhere. They have Liquid IV at Costco, folks. It's a great healthy alternative to traditional sugary sports drinks. It's perfect for fueling through workouts, preventing muscle fatigue, and promoting healthy post-workout recovery. And this is what's really great about it. It comes in these small packets, powdered packets. TSA friendly. You can travel with them. You can have them on the plane. You can have them when you land. You don't have to worry about finding, I don't know, the junk they sell at some Piggly Wiggly somewhere. I love Liquid IV. I know you will too. Right now, my listeners get 25% off at liquidiv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. 25% off anything you order at Liquid IV's website. Go to liquidiv.com. Enter my code, promo code MAJORITY. Get your savings. Start getting better hydration. That's Liquid IV, two letters, IV.com, promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Start properly hydrating today. And also, folks, Babbel will get you speaking a new language quickly and with confidence. I feel like everybody in this office is about to do this. Maybe yes. We should have a competition.
I forfeit.
Is competition going to start kicking in?
I would kick in some competition. I want to start
Jamie's
learning.
Jamie's got a head start on all of us.
I want to learn Portuguese. Well, maybe Jamie could pick up a second language.
We all have to
language.
Do a different language.
Yes. Well, I want to do Spanish too, but you can choose from 14 different languages. Spanish, French, Italian are in there. Portuguese is one of them too, if I remember correctly. Russian.
I'm going to take Portuguese.
Yeah, let's have a Spanish off.
Let's do it. Babbel's teaching method, speech recognition technology, has been proven to be effective across multiple studies. And the thing about Babbel that is different from a lot of these types of apps and whatnot is that their lessons are created by over 100 language experts. In other words, real human beings who understand how you learn a language and understand nuances in words, not by some type of translation machine. The lessons are engaging and they're super convenient. They last only 10, 15 minutes. You can do it, I don't know, on your way walking to the supermarket or driving to the supermarket or walking through the supermarket. Babbel is available as an app or online. Your progress syncs across all your devices. I think we're going to do this. Maybe we should do this. I think we should have like a Babbel language off.
Let's definitely do Spanish.
Because you listen to the show, Babbel has a very special offer for you. You go to babbel.com, select the language of your choice. Once you try for free and are ready to sign up, select the 3-month option, and Babbel will give you 3 additional months for free with promo code MAJORITY. That's 6 months for the cost of 3 with the promo code MAJORITY. Go to Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L. .com. Enter promo code MAJORITY. Babbel, speak a new language with confidence. And lastly, as you know, hiring can be a slow process. And apparently there's this story about this guy, Dylan Miskowitz. Have you heard about him? Altura's COO needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company. He was having trouble finding qualified applicants. Hello, ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Technology identifies people with the right experience, invites them to apply to your job. So, for instance, let's say I'm looking for a producer and it goes out there. I got a ton of super qualified candidates. I could have hired someone literally in the first couple of days. I waited a week. I got a ton more. And then Brendan showed up. And that's how we hired Brendan, through ZipRecruiter. That guy, Dylan, he posted his
Sam
job on ZipRecruiter.
Offered him a rose.
He said that he was impressed by, exactly, by how quickly great candidates apply. That was my experience too. Use ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. If I had to organize the whole thing myself, it would have been a disaster. That's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. And that's how I found Brendan. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employees who post to ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Mine was tiny. Now Brendan has grown it huge.
Competition would start kicking in.
Try ZipRecruiter for free. Our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, we got to take a quick break.
Trump is already threatening Turkey.
What?
29 minutes ago.
He's threatening Turkey?
34 minutes ago, Trump says he will obliterate Turkey's economy if it acts, quote, off limits in Syria.
So you could go in there, but you got to pretend like you're not doing anything.
And the Pentagon has issued its own statement saying it would be destabilizing if Turkey did this. And this is one of those things where I know we have to get to our esteemed guest, but there's like a bigger problem with the sort of chain of command and bigger democracy questions. But this is also, he's so flagrant and ridiculous that other parts of the bureaucracy are kicking in.
It's also a little worrisome. I read, and we will get to, we'll call Ian in just a second, but I read a theory as to why Mattis will not be more critical of Trump is because there's a concern in the military that there is a lot of Trump supporters, which is really terrifying. So in instances like this, where you see the Pentagon brass having to stand up and perhaps push back on certain ideas. The thing that you don't see, in addition to it being problematic, like he is the commander in chief. Right. Sorry, America, you right. voted for him. The other problem is not only from the standpoint of like, I don't think I want to set the precedent where the military gets to tell the president what to do.
Right.
Because he, you know, I don't want them telling Bernie Sanders like, hey, no, we're going in. Sorry, chief.
We don't want them seizing a coup
Commander
on Bernie Sanders either.
But the thing that's also happening simultaneously here that we probably cannot see is that it is weakening the relationship or the command structure in the military, or has the potential to. So happy Monday, and we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ian Haney-Lopez on Merge Less, fusing race and class, winning elections, and saving America. Let's hope. We'll be right back.
You
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at the University of California, Berkeley, author of Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America, Ian Haney Lopez. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to join you.
So you were on this show, I guess maybe it was 2015, maybe it was 2014, talking about your book at the time, Dog Whistle Politics. And this book sort of came out of that one. Is that right?
So the book Dog Whistle Politics is about the use of coded racial appeals in American politics, things like illegal aliens, silent majority, thugs, gangbangers, silent majority, American heartland, all of these terms that, on the one hand, trigger racist stereotypes, and on the other hand, allow politicians to deny that they had any intention to do that at all. That was a book in 2014 that really said, hey, this has been happening for 50 years. And then Donald Trump effectively reads my book of critique as somehow a how-to manual, gets himself elected, precisely by using dog whistle politics. So it was a moment for me of recognizing we need to go beyond simply analyzing what they're doing, and we really need to figure out how to fight back against dog whistling. And I knew by then that Republicans, in order to hone these racially divisive but superficially colorblind messages, that they used focus groups, they used poll testing, they used communications experts. So I resolved to do the same thing. I connected up with a great communication specialist. We hired some fabulous pollsters. We ran a two-year research project, and the aim was to say, how do we explain to the American voter that racism is being used as a divide-and-conquer weapon, and that when we come together, that's when we can all win?
Okay, so you basically adopted, I guess, the methodology of the right on some level to fashion a message that both included race and class in some respects, right? On the right, I mean, they're not ignoring class, they're just fusing race and class in some way that I guess triggers, for lack of a better word, their voters. And if you could too, just if you're speaking on a headset, just keep it in the headset in one location.
Great.
So
I think that's right. I think it's very important to understand that on the right, there's a consistent story about race, government, and class. And the story that the right is always telling, and I want to be clear, this is an underlying story. This is like the skeleton of the messages they communicate. They will almost never say it in precisely these terms, but you'll recognize it. They'll say, listen, you know, you ought to worry about lazy people. You ought to worry about dangerous criminal people. You ought to worry about violent people. And underneath that is, you ought to worry about people of color. And then they segue to a second part, which is to say, and you can't trust government, because government is actually coddling these undeserving people with welfare. Government is throwing open the borders. Government is refusing to control these lawless criminals. And so, this is the third point, you ought to trust yourself to the marketplace. It's really the market that's your salvation. And now, if you kind of back up from that, and this is a story of welfare queens, this is a story of undocumented immigrants going on welfare or getting hospital services. This is the claim that we need businessmen to run the country like a business because the market produces fair outcomes. This is the idea that the market produces fair outcomes is a highly racialized story. It says brown and black people are poor because they deserve to be poor. There's something fundamentally wrong with them. And the market recognizes that. And in turn, it says, anybody who works hard and is a decent, honest person, the sort of stereotype of what it means to be white, those people will succeed. Now, of course, a lot of people don't succeed in the marketplace. And this creates a lot of bitterness, a lot of confusion, a lot of resentment. And so you get this wild phenomena where people are struggling in the marketplace because the jobs aren't there, the economy shifted, the pensions have gone away, but they hate government and they hate welfare, they hate the Affordable Care Act, the very sorts of programs that would help them in an economy that's not working for regular folks, but they hate it because they're steeped in this story that says those are handouts to undeserving people of color.
You know, it's fascinating. There's a there's two things that strike me. One is that the relationship between in that story between government and the free market, I'm not equating these two, but structurally it seems similar to me, is sort of the way that white supremacists use Jews to explain why black people may have achieved more than they have. In certain instances, like there's an interloper in this equation, and that in the context that you're talking about, it's government, and it's government is what is tipping the scales and why they're suffering on some level, because it is allowing the undeserving to achieve when a marketplace, a free market, would just make sure that everything was right. The other thing that strikes me is a piece I read by Monica Potts in the New York Times just yesterday, I think, about Arkansas. And the title of it escapes me at the moment. But it very much talks about this dynamic where you have people who could be helped by government, and they do not even want this help from government. They are, it's in the land of self-defeat. They're suspicious of people who want to come and do material benefits for them because they just have that much distrust of government, broadly speaking. Not that they won't deliver it, but that they will deliver it.
Yes, no, I think that's exactly right. And what we need to do is we need to back up and take a historical perspective. We need to understand that 100 years ago, in the age of the robber barons and the big industry and factories, the titans of the economy were telling people, you're on your own, you don't need unions, you don't need government, the real man provides for himself and negotiates his own contracts. And of course, it was all BS. You can't stand up to the power of money without organizing people. That's just the fundamental fact of social life. Then you get the Depression, and you see, large swaths of the society out of work, losing their homes, farm values plummeting, and people turn around and say, This is not my poverty, the fact that I'm hungry, the fact that I can't take care of my kids, it's not because I'm not trying hard. It's not a matter of individual fault. This is the way the economy has been structured and what the government's doing. And so for the next 30 or 40 years, we have this this long New Deal in which people say, on my own, you're kidding me. The forces arrayed against me are too big. I'm actually connected with everybody else, and we want to make sure government works for us. That was the dominant ethos of the New Deal. That was the dominant ethos among whites. So the really important question is, what produced the sort of ethos that Potts was reporting on in that essay you're talking about in The Land of Self-Defeat? What produced this new ethos which said, I can't trust government. Government's against me. I really am on my own. And one of the things that she said in her article is so interesting is people are moving towards this extreme social isolation, this extreme individualism. They're not helping their neighbors. They fear and distrust their neighbors. They don't want anybody around them, right? What produced that shift? Because it is a big shift. There's nothing natural about it. It wasn't there. It's diametrically opposed to the dominant consensus among whites for 40 years. The consensus, by the way, that built the largest expansion of the middle class in the history of the world. And that's where we come back to the role of dog whistle politics. The titans of industry, the new version, the Goldwaters, and then the Ronald Reagans and General Electric and the Heritage of the Koch brothers, they funded a story that said, we're not all in this together because some people are violent and some people are undeserving. And government,
it's on the side of those violent, undeserving people, not you. Fear people of color, but hate government. And here, just to pick up on a point you were making, it's not just that government is the interloper. Government is the main enemy in the narrative of the right. Government is the main enemy. And what happens when most people think government's the main enemy? It makes it much easier for the few and the wealthy to hijack government for their own purposes.
So I want to pivot to the work that you did in terms of like finding a message that would compete with this one. But to what extent? And this certainly comes through in that essay, because it's about Van Buren County in Arkansas. And to what extent are we talking about? I think it's quite clear the messaging that has gone on. But I wonder if there was certain segment of the population that was more susceptible to this message at that time in the 80s. And, you know, these people are, I think, even more beleaguered, certainly, than they were in the early 80s. I mean, there's a whole host of different things that have contributed to that. But one of the things that has contributed to it, and also I think, and I wonder from your perspective, if it's the case that it also set the context for people to be more receptive to that message. You're on your own, individualism. There are forces out there that want to take stuff from you, that government is giving them largesse and whatnot. Is the rural urban divide that the nature of the people who stay in a small town, I'm not saying all of them, but the nature and the desires and the ambitions or the perspectives of people who stay in a small town in rural America versus those people from that town who say, like, I want to go to the city for whatever reason that they want to go to the city, has self sort of sorted people in such a way that the people who remain in those rural areas are much more susceptible to this message, because also the people who would not be susceptible to that message have moved out already. And so there's no competing narrative that exists in these rural areas.
I think that that's a dynamic. But I also think that we can mislead ourselves if we emphasize dispositional elements or temperamental differences. And so there is this dynamic in which you have commentators on the left who purport to explain, you know, different sorts of brains, different ways we're wired, different fears or fear versus curiosity. You know, okay, I think that there's some role for that. But another way to think about this is the sorts of fears and the sorts of antisocial isolationism and alienation that is now dominant among Republican voters, that used to be associated with the John Birch Society and, you know, 5, 6, 8% of the population, the most extreme, the most paranoid. If you wanted to explain Birchers, I'd say, okay, if we're talking 5 or 6 or 8% of the population, let's look at psychological factors. What is going on with these folks? But when you want to explain half the population and you want to explain a shift that occurred relatively rapidly, that is mid-1960s, landslide election for Lyndon Johnson when he promises a war on poverty, 1972 landslide election for Richard Nixon when he promises to turn back the Democratic tide and protect the silent majority, that's not psychological factors. That's not temperamental differences. That's a major shift in the cultural and political story that people are telling themselves. And so while I think that these dispositional elements are there, I want us to focus on the way in which a story of racial conflict, government betrayal, and a dependence on market actors, that is purposefully produced with the implication that it can be purposefully defeated.
Okay, interesting. And so, and I guess I should just say, though, that I'm not necessarily talking even necessarily about the these predispositions as much as I also am talking about the sort of the fact of the matter is, if you live in a rural area, and and even doesn't even necessarily have to be in a rural area. I grew up in a city that I think was extremely suspicious of outsiders. The second biggest city in New England, but extremely suspicious of outsiders and outside elements and et cetera, et cetera. And it's, and I've lived in small rural areas, and that is a very prominent sense. And I don't know that it's psychological as much as, as your context of where you live in. You're just not exposed to certain things.
That's right.
And go ahead.
The key to me there is segregation, the physical, spatial, social segregation. What we see in our research is that the people who are most racially fearful live in the areas in which there are the fewest people of color. When people are socially isolated from others, it becomes much easier for them to be fearful of these others, for them to understand and view others almost exclusively through racist stereotypes. It's when you get to know people and you get to appreciate that cultural differences, linguistic differences, differences in skin color or in religion don't make people fundamentally scary or threatening. That's when you can actually immunize people against political stories that say, don't worry about the rich and powerful, worry about people who don't quite look like you.
Okay, so let's talk about how one does that to a certain extent. So when you set out, and I know you did this in conjunction with some folks from Demos, set out to sort of determine what kind of narrative you can that cuts through this this now predisposition that significant portion of our country, 45% maybe, have in terms of this story they tell themselves. Give us some examples of how you developed that. I mean, I know Indiana, there was a you did a poll in Indiana. Maybe let's start there.
We need to depress your audience just a little further before we. There is
all my audience is depressed. But yes, go ahead.
We got to depress them a lot. So, in one way we're talking about Trump voters, but when we set out to figure out how powerful these messages were, the first thing we did was we tested essentially the sort of racialized rhetoric that Trump uses. And what we found is if you have a message about people from terrorist countries who wish us harm or people from countries who've entered illegally and don't respect our laws, the sort of things that we understand as racist dog whistles, when we tested that message, we found that that message was convincing to the majority of Republicans and the majority of Democrats and the majority of African Americans and the majority of Latinos. That is, once you take the highly racialized narrative that the right is telling and you switch it into code so that you're not using expressly racial terms, that story of threat from brown and black people is actually convincing to a wide swath of Americans, the majority of Republicans, Dems, African Americans, Latinos. There's a lot of power there. So part of what we're doing is we're not just – this isn't a project just to say, okay, how do we win over Republican voters? This is a project that says, how do we bring over about 60% of the American public who fall into a persuadable category of both being susceptible to racial fear but also being committed to positive visions of people of color and government. And just to be clear, the majority of African Americans and the majority of Latinos are in that persuadable middle.
Okay, and so I guess that's depressing in the sense that we're all susceptible to these narratives that I guess trigger some of our fears. So let's move. Let's make that pivot. Where did you start in terms of language that you or a narrative that that was effective with all of these folks?
What we started with was the insight that if we accuse Republicans or Donald Trump of being a racist, that deepens the divide because it strengthens the narrative that this is white people against people of color. If instead we start with the point that racism is being used as a divide and conquer weapon against all of us, that created room for inclusion. Now, it was very important to take the next step and not simply say they're trying to divide us, but to really affirmatively insist we want to come together. They're trying to divide us across race lines. We want to come together across race lines, white, brown, black, whatever color, whatever national origin, we want to come together. Because when we come together, that's when we can take this country back. That turned out to be that culmination of naming division, but explaining it as a weapon of corrupt billionaires against all of us, and then affirmatively saying, let's come together. When we come together across race lines, that's how we make this a country that works for all of us. That turned out to be a very, very powerful message. It beat the dog whistle racial fear message. It was also more powerful than standard Democratic messages that either called out the Republicans for being racist or tried to avoid talking about race altogether.
I mean, in some ways, wasn't that Obama's message? There's no red America. There's no blue America. And I don't know who the they is in this instance. I don't know that he was was so explicit about billionaires and this and that, but there were times he would sort of hint at some type of populism. But wasn't that largely the message?
It was potentially his message. I think had he made it his message, we would have had a very different presidency and a very different slate of legislative accomplishments. Listen, so Obama comes in and he says, "Let's all come together, hope and change." But at the same time that he's doing that, he's suppressing two critical messages. One, that while we're all coming together, that the reason we need to come together is because we're losing the class war, that there's a class war that's going on. It's been going on for 50 years and we're losing. And if we don't come together, we can't fight back. And Obama simply was not interested in making that point. And the other thing about Obama is he said, let's all come together as a way to bury the race conversation, as a way to sidestep it, to say, I'm not going to talk about it. And it's one of the strange marks of the Obama years that Obama talked about racial division in the United States less than any Democratic president since FDR. Obama did this sort of, we're all in this together as a kind of a cliche. Let's hold hands where everything's fine. We're just going to march into a future, but I'm not going to tell you who the enemy is, and I'm not going to tell you what sorts of divisions are being used against us. It's all going to be good. That worked in 2008 in the depths of a recession, and given the calamity of the Bush administration, it worked less well in 2012. Obama's remarkable for having won re-election with less support than his initial election, and it simply failed for Hillary Clinton. People want a story that says we need to come together because there's a class war going on and they're using division against us. And we want to come together in a way that names racism expressly as a problem that we have to overcome because we see that racism's tearing this country apart. And we want it named and we want to challenge it. We don't want to hide from it anymore. And those are the two crucial differences with Obama's message. Name class war and name racism as the weapon that's being used against all of us, and cross-racial solidarity as the route forward, not only for racial justice, but for economic fairness for everybody of every color.
It seems like the message has... that the class war message is a non-passive voice one. In other words, we know who we name who in this message who's waging this class war, right? The billionaire class.
I
think other people would say maybe capitalists, but for the ease of understanding, and I guess I would imagine, for just like a colloquialism, is billionaires. Wealthy, right. Greedy people. But what do we say about racism? I mean, how is it that the class war has a perpetrator, but racism doesn't? Or is that just a strategic?
Oh, racism? No, racism has a perpetrator. Donald Trump, Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, all of the millionaires shilling for billionaires by stoking racist hatred in our country. And we should be clear. I mean, this, in the way that Elizabeth Warren says Fox News is hate for profit, the hate is especially racist hatred. They are stoking racist hatred for profit, right? And it's very important to name that as what's going on. There are prominent people who are making a mint by getting us to hate each other and to fight each other along race lines. And while we're at it, we might throw Russia and Russia's bots into the mix. And it's, you know, in one sense, it's kind of a joke, and in another sense, it's deadly serious. Russia understood that if it wanted to help Donald Trump win election in 2016, the way to do that was to stoke racial acrimony through social media in the United States. In fact, here's how I put this. It's one of the most important insights of this dog whistle politics story to recognize racism isn't something that just floats out there in the sort of this miasma or the culture, nor is racism just a vestige of hundreds of years of discrimination. Both of those are true, but those are insufficient ways of understanding racism. Racism is as powerful and as pervasive today because some of society's most powerful, most wealthy segments see a profit for themselves in funding it. And that sounds dramatic until you think, well, okay, Koch brothers, petrochemical industry, how do they protect their interests? How do they block us from enacting any environmental legislation? Partly they do it through the usual, hire a bunch of lobbyists. Partly they do it through peddling a bunch of fake science. But in the main, they do it by funding groups like the Tea Party, groups that organize people around stories of racist fear and resentment. Or the Mercers who make their fortune on Wall Street. What do they fund? Breitbart and Steve Bannon, who organize and rile up voters through racist stereotypes. We are living in a world now in which racism is the main weapon of economic titans against the rest of us.
And how receptive are those on the right to hearing Limbaugh's name or Hannity's name or Carlson's name? Because I would imagine that becomes, then they start to, they're like, wait a second. It's one thing, I don't like the Kochs. I don't know who they are. This guy Mercer, whoever, even Donald Trump. I think, you know, we can argue that he's sometimes I don't like him on Twitter. This is my conservative. I'm inhabiting a conservative now. But wait a second. Rush, I've been listening to for 20 years. Sean Hannity is my guy. Tucker Carlson, I don't like how he's a little uppity, but he's still pretty straight shooter. I mean, what happens when you introduce them as being the purveyors of this? How receptive are people? Or are we talking about people? There's a limited number of these people on the right who are receptive to this message, and we hit them.
So when we segmented the American electorate, we found that there was about 23% of the national electorate were consistently progressive. About 18% of the national electorate were consistently conservative, or I would say reactionary is a better term. We're not going to reach that 18%. But that left 59% who are toggling in between. And those are the people that we can reach with this message that says they're trying to divide us. Let's come together. Together we can make this the country we want. That same message also plays really well with the progressive base. And this is an important insight. We don't have to message separately to reach people who are in this persuadable voter segment or who are Democratic base voters.
likewise, we don't have to message separately to reach whites and people of color. This message of cross-racial solidarity was the most popular message with both whites and people of color. But that's the strength of this approach. It is a unifying message, not only in its substance, hey, we need to come together, but it's a unifying message in the sense that it is the most popular message with all of the important segments of the Democratic base.
Well, before I get to that question, I just want to talk about that poll in Indiana and the one polling that you did in Minnesota, because both those sort of stick out for me in terms of, you know, sort of very definitional as to this era.
So what we wanted to do is we wanted to figure out how these sorts of messages would play in very different states. And the pattern was consistent, though we found that in swing states like Indiana, there was much greater polarization. You had people who were more consistently reactionary, people who were more consistently part of the progressive base. But even in a place like Indiana, we found a pattern in which a message of cross-racial solidarity worked. It was the strongest message, that a message of economic populism that tried to stay silent about race would work with the Democratic base, but would not work as well with persuadables, and that a message that really challenged racism, but in this sort of whites against non-whites sense of challenging racism, that was the message that performed the most poorly. Coming back to Minnesota, there was research that was done by a group, Faith in Minnesota, that was, they were drawing on a research. They did their own independent canvassing project, and it was really stunning research. They started by showing people flyers that was essentially copied from a Republican flyer that was in actual distribution. And they asked people, do you agree or do you disagree? And they found very high levels of agreement with this Republican flyer, again, including they did it with whites in rural Minnesota and people of color in urban Minnesota, found very high levels of agreement. When they then came back to these same folks,
will you articulate what that flyer said?
The flyer was the typical dog whistle message that said, we need to keep our community safe. We need to protect our people first. My opponent wants sanctuary cities. Businessmen are what make this country great, right? That sort of, basically the Republican themes, a few of them centered on economics and trusting business, but most of them promoting a narrative of threatening and undeserving people, and implicitly people of color. That message was very popular.
Okay. And
when we came there,
go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So when we showed the same people a message that said, we all want something similar, but our opponents are trying to divide us. When they divide us, we all lose. When we come together, that's when we can get the things we need, like healthcare and good jobs and a beautiful Minnesota. Not only was that message popular across the board, it was actually a winning message among whites who initially agreed with the dog whistle racial fear message. And this is a very important point, because I think a lot of us have this sense that, hey, if anybody agrees with these racialized messages against immigrants and sanctuary cities and all of that, they're just racist, as if that's one thing and it explains their whole world outlook. And yes, there is a lot of susceptibility to racist stereotypes. But these same folks also can be pulled in a racially progressive direction if they understand how their racial ideals are the route forward for themselves and their families.
Interesting. Well, who do you perceive in our political world today who is delivering, or what people, I should say, are delivering something, if not this message, something close to this message, I mean, do you see every... I think is every Democratic candidate... Let's put it this way. Is every Democratic candidate similarly situated to deliver this message? Are there some that are already doing it? I mean, who out there is modeling this well and who's modeling it poorly?
It's a really great question. So I want to distinguish this message from something that is common among Democratic candidates. Many Democratic candidates say, we need economic populism and we need racial justice. We should do both. But notice that they're essentially separate messages, and it's not clear why we should do both. And in some ways, these messages seem to be in tension, because when Democrats say they want to do racial justice, that sounds to a lot of people, hear that through the Republican frame that says, see, Democrats only care about people of color. This message is a race fused to class message that says we want economic populism, and that means that we have to deal with racial division because that's what's stopping us. And we want racial justice, and that means we need to deal with a multiracial we need to build a multiracial coalition for economic populism, because it's these dog whistle politicians who are at the root of some of the most severe violence against communities of color. That is, if you want racial justice, you need a multiracial coalition to defeat dog whistle politics. If you want economic populism, you need a multiracial coalition to defeat dog whistle politics. These, whatever your agenda, these are fused. Now, from that point of view, who are the can any Democratic candidate say this? You got to step back and say, what is their position on economic populism? Because the idea that there is a class war and that that's why we need to come together, that's central to making sure that this new approach to unity really works. People need to understand what's in it for them, or alternately, why they can expect others to join this coalition. So if you have candidates who want to shy away from the idea that the system is rigged, they're going to have a much harder time with this statement. Likewise, you need candidates who are comfortable talking about race. If you have candidates who don't have a good history of talking about race, don't get it, don't really understand it, to be perfectly frank, see racial justice as something they need to do for some particular constituents, but it's not their thing, they're going to have a hard time with this message. You read that the strongest candidates for this sort of approach are candidates who understand there's been a class war going on for 50 years. We need to rewrite the rules to help all of us. And all of us really means all of us. And that means things like racial justice and repair, reparations. Those are essential to making us into the sort of society in which everybody has a decent chance to thrive. And now those candidates are in the best position to say, and these two goals are linked. Economic populism and a society in which people of every color have the best opportunity to thrive, those two are inseparably linked.
And so who do you see is doing that? To me, the sort of the most natural person who comes to mind when I think about that is AOC. On some level. And then, just in terms of American politics, but maybe you have a different sense. But who?
No, I think that that's right. I think that there are people like AOC, Elizabeth Warren, Reverend William Barber, in terms of organizing a cross-racial movement in North Carolina, and now a sort of a rejuvenated poor people's movement across the country. There are folks who, sometimes they get this exactly right. Sometimes they drift just a little bit. For someone like AOC, I would say a lot of the time she's really on this idea of intentional division and class war, and we need to come together. But sometimes she moves towards the, we need to denounce Trump for being a bigot or for being an anti-Semite side. And yes, I understand he is a bigot. Yes, I understand he's an anti-Semite. But I also understand labeling him that actually helps him. Because what it does is it deepens his story that this is fundamentally a racial conflict between warring racial groups, and implicitly he represents white folks.
That's sort of so like try not to think of an elephant type of theory, right? Like as soon as you you name that dynamic, it immediately redounds to his story.
It confirms his story. It confirms his story because, again, remember, the vast majority of people do not hear what Trump is saying as racist. When he says we need to shut the border against people who come from terrorist countries who mean us harm, there is a set of us who are like, yo, that's racist. That's not the vast majority of Americans. Vast majority of Americans say, oh, yeah, we need to protect ourselves. So when the left turns around and says, hey, Trump, you're a bigot for saying that, most people say to themselves, well, I believe that. Am I a bigot? Are you calling me a bigot? And right there, that's when progressives lose. It's much more effective to stay consistent and to say Trump's a racist in the sense that he's a strategic racist. He's a carnival barker. He's running a con, and racism's his con. I want to be crystal clear. I am not saying don't call Trump a racist. Call him a racist. But make sure you're clear about what kind of racist he is.
Right,
you're saying
make sure that the critique is that he's using racism as a tool and labeling him as secondary as long as racism is being centered as a tool that is creating a class division, and he's doing this on the behest or in service of those who control the economy.
I think that's right. So, in fact, that's exactly right. Make it clear that racism is a weapon against all of us. Now, it's also important to make it clear that we're not all getting hurt the same, that when racism is used as a way to win elections, you end up with government that specifically targets communities of color, mass incarceration, mass deportation, mass surveillance, systemic neglect. That's what you get when the country elects politicians who campaign on the basis of racist messages. So we're not getting hurt the same way, but we are all getting hurt. And because we're all getting hurt, it does create the possibility of a cross-racial movement to drive out of politics these politicians who keep winning by dividing us.
You didn't mention Bernie Sanders there. Where do you think that he's not delivering that type of message about racism as a mechanism to fuel a class war?
I think that he sometimes does that, and sometimes Bernie will say Trump is using racism to scapegoat people, and I think that that's exactly right when he says that, but very often he defaults to a worldview that says economic inequality is the fundamental problem. And then he'll say, and so you can see that when people are suffering, politicians will scapegoat. And you start to see the way in which the race part is secondary to the story he's telling. And it becomes even more secondary when he says, let's deal with economic inequality first. That will disproportionately help people of color because they're disproportionately poor. So my economic populism is really racial justice, right? This is the answer he gives in terms of reparations. He says, well, I don't support reparations, but if we do all of the things that I say we should do in terms of economic populism, that's going to help lots of people of color. And again, you get this sense from Bernie's like racism second. And the mistake is to not recognize that economic inequality in the United States of the sort we're living in 2019 is directly a result of the power of racial division. And that racial division began to divide folks, break the New Deal coalition, and create popular support for rule by the rich when people were doing fine. It wasn't economic calamity that led to scapegoating, that led to people to look around for someone to blame. It was Republican politicians in the 1960s when most whites were doing great, having come off of the Long New Deal, led them when they're doing fine to say,
"So racism,
we're worried that government is favoring these other undeserving people."
So racism is the sword wielded by the billionaires, not the shield, when there's some type of response to what you've done to us.
I like the metaphor. I would just say it's both, right? It's both shield and sword.
Right.
it becomes a really powerful feedback loop. They use it as a sword to divide us. Economic hardship ensues. People look around for someone to blame, and then they use it as a shield. They don't blame us. You should blame those poor people, those poor brown and black people. It's this, it becomes this feedback loop, and the only way out of it is really to say, this is being used against all of us. People power is the only response to the power of big money.
Ian Haney Lopez, the book is Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. Folks, we will put a link to this book on majority.fm. It has all the, obviously, the data and the to sort of back up what we've been talking about here. Ian, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a great conversation.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Interesting stuff. Very interesting stuff.
You know, the first miscegenation laws in the U.S. were created as a response to Bacon's Rebellion, wherein poor white indentured servants and black slaves rose up against the governor together, and it scared the shit out of the ruling class.
There you go.
Racism is a bourgeois ideology designed to divide the working class.
There you go. I was going to say, like, this is Jamie's... he won't say capital, he'll say billionaires, but it's the same thing. I mean, one is a little bit less theoretical, one's a little bit more colloquial.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I would only add that in addition to elections, we need to unite across racial lines to organize for worker power, working class power, and all the power that we need to take back the world.
I wonder if they have specific numbers on reparations in the polling.
Check
that. That's an interesting fusion he's going there, because I mean, it's a fascinating argument, but then, I mean, I've certainly never seen, I'm talking just on an objective level, any type of broad-based support for reparations in any type of polling anywhere. So that's a kind of interesting fusion of sort of emphasizing a mass message and then talking about that policy specifically, which I always do just like to say every time somebody brings that up, Marianne Williamson is the only reparations candidate. I think we should keep that on doc.
You know, I've kind
of... She's still in the race?
I think she... I mean, she hasn't
dropped
out.
I got a text message from her team that there's a fundraiser in Brooklyn, I think, this weekend.
Oh, hell yeah.
Really?
Let's go.
How do you get all those text messages?
I don't know. Zip I just recruiter. Put my Weird. Phone in on the internet on rent, like, you know, Applebee's gift cards, and
all I get is the IRS fake calls.
You know, I've come around on reparations those? After reading some socialists on the fight for reparations and the connection between the fight for reparations and the fight against capitalism. Can't do reparations without coming after capitalism. So
there you go, folks. You can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show that you just listened to. Not only that, we give you extra content that you could listen to going forward from this very moment. And getting back to the free show that you listened to, you get that commercial free. So join the Majority Report today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, the AM Quickie, it's live on its own feed. Go to amquickie.com to sign up, or just check your local podcast listings, as it were. You can join us in the fun half today. We have, bless his heart. I've been very difficult. I've been very hard on Scaramucci.
He's officially friend of show.
But apparently I know it looks like it, but I didn't say a word to this dude. He just stepped up and did one of those cameos.
He did the right thing.
You know, calling out Crowder. We will play that in the fun half. Also, we will talk more about what's happening with Donald Trump selling out the Kurds, although he seems to have backtracked. Apparently, he got a phone call from somebody. I don't even know what to say. We will talk about the revelations that there is a second whistleblower, to the extent that that's even relevant. We'll talk about the subpoena to the White House. We'll talk about Rick Perry. We're going to get more into this stuff tomorrow on the news, but we will check it all out. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Today is Monday. Tomorrow is Tuesday. Michael, I hope your voice is better.
Me too. I'll drink a lot of tea tonight. Tomorrow, we have Heidi Sloan, who's running for Congress, DSA in Texas. What does a socialist message for Texas mean and look like? And then I'm going to have a little bit of a debate, actually, with Sagar from Rising. He's Crystal Ball's co-host, or she's his co-host as well. And we're going to do a sort of socialism versus nationalism debate on how to address income inequality. So all that and much more, which hopefully I'll be able to elaborate tomorrow. And then grab your tickets to the Philly Live Show, November 23rd, with Emma Viglin, Crystal Ball, Artesia Balthrop.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we had on Nadja Guyot, an organizer from No New Jails NYC, to talk about No New Jails' fight to defeat Bill de Blasio's plan to close Rikers and replace it with all these borough-based justice hubs that are supposed to be more humane but are actually quite dystopian. And they're fighting this fight. It's really important right now for people to be aware of it and get involved. We also talked about prison abolition more generally as an idea and a framework for the work that we're doing in the present and beyond. We are also recording a new episode with Ross Wolf today on borders and economic nationalism, making the case for why we cannot solve the immigration problem within the bounds of social democracy in one country. Also, we have a live show coming up this weekend. Saturday, October 12th at Littlefield with the Antifada and Pod Damn America and all sorts of really good guests.
Oh, shit. This weekend?
Heck yeah. You want to come?
If I'm in town, I definitely will. Matt is not here, but Literary Hangover lives on online at patreon.com/literaryhangover. This week, I can't remember what he's doing, but he'll tell you tomorrow. I'll tell you tomorrow. I mean, that is, his stuff is evergreen. It's super evergreen.
Oh my God. And we released a new Vampire Castle where we talk about The Crow. I'm so sorry.
There you go. Folks, see you in the fun half. Left is best.